From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Now that NATO has shot down Serbian fighter planes, how has the picture changed in Bosnia? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Misha Glenny. He's covered the Balkans for the BBC and is the author of The Fall of Yugoslavia. His most recent trip to Sarajevo was right after the attack on the marketplace. Also, commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews two novels about sexual obsession, Robert Olin Butler's They Whisper and Nicholson Baker's The Fermata. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton and British Prime Minister John Major have concluded their official meeting. Both men worked over breakfast at the White House this morning, then held a news conference. Bosnia occupied much of the discussion. Major says that now that the truce is holding in Sarajevo, a mission from both countries will go to the city to see what help that residents need to rebuild.
The circumstances that exist within Sarajevo are still very serious. The utilities aren't working, the electricity, the water. So we've agreed to send a joint civil planning mission there to have a look at what needs to be done and then to see to what extent we can contribute and can encourage other people to contribute to deal with the civil difficulties that are actually faced there in Sarajevo.
A spokesman for Jewish settlers in the West Bank says Israeli soldiers accidentally shot a settler and his wife today. The man died and the woman was injured. The occupied territories have been tense and rioting has broken out since a Jewish settler shot and killed dozens of Palestinians last Friday at a mosque. No reason has been given for the shootings today. The army says that it is investigating. The Senate has rejected one proposed amendment to balance the budget this afternoon. It will consider the more well-known Simon Amendment later today. Two former lawmakers are calling on their old colleagues to support the amendment or explain how they'll cut the deficit without it. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Former Senators Warren Rudman and Paul Tsongas, who formed the Concord Coalition to campaign against budget deficits, admit that they were against the idea of a balanced budget amendment while they were in office. But now both believe there's no hope for balancing the budget without it. Tsongas called on lawmakers who oppose the measure to come up with some alternatives.
I understand the arguments against the balanced budget amendment. I think there's some pretty strong ones. But if you're going to take that position, influence how people vote, you have an enormous moral responsibility to then take up the crusade. What you have are strong statements against it, and then, okay, that's yesterday's issue, let's go on and worry about how much money Nancy Kerrigan's going to make. So that's not responsible.
Supporters are reportedly several votes short of what they need to pass the amendment when it comes up for a vote tonight. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
International weapons inspectors are in North Korea to begin their tour of suspected nuclear sites. The trip has been delayed for a long time. The group of six plans to begin work tomorrow at main facilities they're supposed to examine. North Korea denies Western charges that it's building a nuclear bomb. It has refused to let inspectors visit the seven suspect sites, but it gave in to international pressure last week. The stalemate could have led to international sanctions, but the UN isn't satisfied yet. There are two more sites that the UN wants to see. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 27 points at 3803. The Nasdaq has fallen 7.5 to 785. This is NPR. The House has suspended all legislative business to accommodate Congressman William Natcher. He's never missed a vote. Natcher has been hospitalized, and he's asked that the House put off voting for a day. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
84-year-old William Natcher, a Democrat from Kentucky, holds the House record, 18,397 uninterrupted votes. Natcher, according to his office, was hospitalized today for non-surgical treatment of an intestinal problem. He asked House Speaker Tom Foley to put off action on an education bill lest his record be spoiled. The House took what Foley described as a highly unusual step, and Majority Leader Richard Gephardt announced the postponement.
This is a human institution that has to pay attention to human needs within the institution, and that's what we try to do today.
Natcher has been in and out of the hospital for the past month. He returned last week for a vote in a wheelchair. Today's request to postpone business was met with little resistance. He says it's his intention to return to the Capitol tomorrow. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The government says the economy grew 7.5% in the fourth quarter of last year. The Commerce Department says that's the fastest rate in 10 years. Some private analysts say that's a reflection of higher U.S. exports and more consumer spending. Financial markets have worried the economy is expanding too quickly, but Federal Reserve officials say that's not a major worry. The Fed has already acted to squash threats of inflation by raising short-term interest rates. A published report says the founder of the National Hockey League Players Association will be indicted this week on federal labor racketeering charges. The Boston Globe says R. Allen Eagleson will be charged with defrauding the players' union and misappropriating money from hockey tournaments that he set up, like the Canada Cup. This would be the first time that labor racketeering charges have been applied to a professional sports figure. The U.S. Attorney's Office and a federal grand jury have reportedly been investigating him. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's a very confusing time in Bosnia. It's unclear whether this is the beginning of the end of the war or the war is about to widen. Yesterday, American fighter planes shot down four Serbian warplanes that had violated the UN's no-fly zone. The Serbian planes had bombed a munitions plant controlled by the Bosnian government. This marked not only the first time NATO used military power in Bosnia, it was the first NATO military strike in its history. Last month, NATO gave an ultimatum to the Serbs to remove its heavy artillery from an over 12-mile zone around Sarajevo. That has eased things for people in Sarajevo, but there are now reports of increased Serb attacks in other Bosnian cities under siege. My guest Misha Glenny has covered the war for the BBC. He's also the author of the book The Fall of Yugoslavia. Glenny is now stationed in northern Greece, where he's watching developments in the southern Balkans. He's recently traveled through Croatia and Bosnia.
I traveled to Sarajevo almost immediately after the big mortar attack on the marketplace in Sarajevo and spent quite a lot of time there trying to understand what the dynamics of the ultimatum, the NATO ultimatum, that is, to use airstrikes around Sarajevo, and also the Russian and Serbian response with the deployment of Russian troops, the pullout of Serbian weapons, what that dynamic was. I've been talking to as many people as possible from the international side as well, American diplomats, United Nations people. It's really always very important, in my opinion, in order to understand this war, both to keep traveling to places like Sarajevo, but also to get out of places like Sarajevo, because if you just remain in one place or on one side in this war, then you begin to suffer from what we journalists call the Sarajevo syndrome.
What's that?
Well, it means that, you know, you're sitting in Sarajevo in a besieged city, spending most of the past 2 years being bombed by Serbian shells and shot at by Serbian snipers, and you begin more and more, and it happens to all of us, to identify exclusively with one side without taking into account what the sort of broader political games going on in and around the war are. And so I feel the best thing for me, certainly, is always to leap around from one place to the next to try and get a sort of balanced and, above all, a global overall perspective on it.
What's your reaction to the airstrike against the Serbian fighter planes?
Well, I think it's perfectly legitimate within the framework of the no-fly zone resolution. This no-fly zone has been violated chronically hundreds and hundreds and thousands, indeed, of times since it was introduced, but almost always by helicopters. And it's much easier for helicopters to get away with violating the no-fly zone than it is for jet planes. I might add that, I mean, all sides have been doing it. The Bosnian government now has 18 helicopters and has been violating it more than anyone else of late. But this attack on the munitions factory in Novi Travnik, the Muslim munitions factory, by the Serb planes yesterday was a gross provocation. And I think NATO handled it correctly and was perfectly within its rights to attack these planes.
Do you think this is likely to get the Serbs to back down or to widen the war?
I don't think that it's, in the first instance, going to do anything. The Russians have given their slightly qualified support to the use of the NATO planes against the Serb planes, but that's a very important signal. It means the Russians are not going to make an issue out of it. And I think what the Bosnian Serbs were doing with this attack, with this conscious provocation, was to test the water of NATO's resolve and see how much they could get away with without NATO responding. And so, my feeling at the moment is that it's not going to shift the balance of the war much one way or the other. But we'll wait and see. It is, of course, a very, very major thing for NATO, because this all huge, massive military machine organised in 1949 has used its power for the first time in 44 years. And that obviously will have a sort of psychological and political impact on NATO and its role in Europe.
Do you expect the Serbs to retaliate?
At the moment, I don't think they do. The point is the attack itself, I suspect, was a retaliation against the negotiations going on in Washington.
Between the Croats and Muslims.
Between the Croats and the Muslims, with the Americans attempting to create a Croat-Muslim alliance, which is a very, very bold diplomatic attempt, because the Croats and Muslims are fighting so much in central Bosnia and around Mostar. And that the Serbs were... I've been watching the Serb reaction to this... These negotiations in Washington, and they're basically saying, the Serbs, that if this is any attempt to tip the military balance against the Bosnian Serbs, then as far as they're concerned, they're going to do everything they can to trash it. And so I think the Serbs were both warning, giving their response to the negotiations, A, and B, testing NATO's resolve. My feeling is that they're not going to react beyond that, if only because today in Russia, Radovan Karadzic, the Bosnian Serb leader, and who's visiting there, and Andrei Kozyrev, the Russian foreign minister, have announced that the Bosnian Serbs are going to allow the opening of Tuzla Airport in central Bosnia, which is a central demand of the West and the United Nations at the moment. And so it looks as though at the moment the Bosnian Serbs are cooperating, but I wouldn't say that that cooperation is guaranteed for a very long time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Misha Glennie. He's covered the war in the former Yugoslavia for the BBC and is the author of the book The Fall of Yugoslavia. The NATO air attack was against the violation of the 11-month-old no-fly zone that was imposed by the UN. It wasn't against a violation of the more recent NATO deadline to remove heavy guns from around Sarajevo. What did you think of that NATO ultimatum about removing heavy guns from around Sarajevo? Did you think that was a good idea?
Well, I think that it was a very risky policy. It was a policy which could have had a very high payoff, and in fact has had a pretty high payoff, but also could have had very, very dangerous and negative consequences for Europe. The NATO ultimatum came after the attack on the marketplace, and clearly people's patience, particularly in Washington, with these sorts of attacks snapped. Now, there is a problem about the marketplace attack because there is no official admission as to who did this attack. Now, I'm fairly certain that the United Nations, contrary to what it says, is well aware who attacked the marketplace and has been holding this information back.
Why would they do that?
For some reason. I think probably to apply pressure on the side responsible for it.
Are you assuming that the side responsible is the Serbian side?
I'm not assuming anything. I'm just saying that I think the United Nations knows who did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, and it could have been either side
mm-hmm.
who did it. Whoever did it, I have a very strong suspicion, which is based on some knowledge, that the UN has been using this in order to pressurize one side to behave properly in terms of negotiations. So anyway, once the marketplace happens, you get the Western response, which is to say, right, enough is enough. And in a way, it doesn't matter whether it was the Muslims or the Serbs who did it by now, because clearly this is the culmination of people finding atrocities intolerable. And NATO really gets going. The Muslims finally see the light at the end of the tunnel, because their military tactic for a long, long time, their only tactic for a long time, has been get NATO in on the side of the Bosnian government, because that's the only way that they can beat the Serbs militarily. If NATO were to come in, within the terms of the ultimatum even, and start taking out Serbian positions around Sarajevo, then NATO would be at war with the Bosnian Serbs. Now, at the moment, NATO doesn't know what that means, nor do the Bosnian Serbs, but it could be something extremely dangerous. So dangerous that the Russians decided, we can't allow this to happen. We simply can't tolerate the Americans fighting with people who we believe are not 100% 100% responsible for this war, and with whom we have all these old traditional ties and so on. And so the Russians responded very swiftly by coming in and saying, well, look, we will persuade the Bosnian Serbs to get their guns away from the hills, but we have to give them certain guarantees, so we will be deployed along the front line in Sarajevo, which is what has happened, and we will guarantee that these front lines stick as they are now. Now, until the Russians did that, the Serbs were not pulling their guns out of Sarajevo at a fast enough speed to meet the requirements of the ultimatum. Until the Russians came in with that diplomatic initiative, you can bet your life that there would have been airstrikes against the Bosnian Serbs.
I think to most Americans, we've been assuming that the Serbs' denial of shelling the Sarajevo marketplace is just a really cynical maneuver on their part. Do you think it's conceivable that Muslims shelled the marketplace to get more sympathy in the West?
I think it's perfectly conceivable that that was the case. I cannot say whether it's the Serbs or the Muslims. I think in terms of the politics of the situation, it's much more likely to have been the Muslims than the Serbs. But I'm not in a position to know. But I do know that the United Nations knows, and that for whatever reason, it's withholding that information.
Russia is hoping for financial aid from the West. Now it's sent troops to Sarajevo in what appears to be a kind of siding with the Serbs. Do you think that this kind of defines a new, more ambiguous post-Cold War relationship between Russia and the West? It's sometimes hard to figure out whether we're allies or whether we're about to be foes again.
Yeah, the backing up of the Serbs in Sarajevo is a modest support for the Serbs. I mean, it's essentially part of a diplomatic activity which has tried to reduce tension in the Balkans. But the question is extremely germane. I think that the problems go back to President Yeltsin's domestic problems in Russia. He's under enormous pressure from nationalists like the extremist Vladimir Zhirinovsky, but he's also under great pressure from people inside the military. And you've seen everybody change their tone in Russia over the past 4 or 5 months from one of sort of liberalism and cosmopolitanism and internationalism to one of creeping conservatism and nationalism. And you see a real turn to the right, I think. I mean, a perceptible turn to the right in the Yeltsin administration, under the pressure of nationalism and under the pressure of economic collapse. And, of course, one of the sort of responses to that is to flex one's muscles, which the Russians are doing, saying that the Americans cannot think that they are able to dictate everything that is going on in Europe, which is what happened when the NATO ultimatum took place in Bosnia, is that Yeltsin's response is, you are bypassing the Security Council, and it is only the Security Council which has the power to authorize airstrikes or not, and you cannot do this sort of thing without Russian cooperation. Now, this was a fairly serious threat from Yeltsin, and it suggests to me that we are entering an extremely difficult phase, if not a crisis, in Russian-American relations. And, of course, not enough money has reached Russia yet in order for the ordinary people in Russia to perceive that the West is helping. So, both sides are in a very difficult position over this, both Yeltsin and Clinton, and I think that you see tension rising in places like Yugoslavia because the West, not only America but also Western Europe, has not been able to do enough to stabilize the psychology and the economy of the Russian people.
My guest is former BBC correspondent Misha Glennie. He's the author of the book The Fall of Yugoslavia. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Misha Glennie. He's covered the war in Bosnia for the BBC and is the author of the book, The Fall of Yugoslavia. Shortly after the bombing of the marketplace in Sarajevo, you went to Sarajevo. Where did you spend most of your time and what were you looking for?
I was inside Sarajevo itself, and I wanted to find out who fired that mortar. I wanted to find out what Lieutenant General Sir Michael Rose, what sort of an impact the new UN commander in Sarajevo was having. And I must say he's had a phenomenal impact. It's the first time that we've seen a UN commander in Sarajevo who goes in to see both sides, threatens them, swears at them, and says unless they stop lying and cheating and trying to pull back on things that they've promised, then he won't hesitate to use whatever means are available him to do something. And I think this is partly why we got this break in Sarajevo, was because Rose is just such a dynamic character who doesn't take any nonsense from these people. So I went there for that reason. Chiefly, though, I was going because of the mortar having been fired, to see what sort of impact this would have on the war. The people in Sarajevo, the ordinary population, were notably less interested in seeing airstrikes taking place than the government in Sarajevo, the Bosnian government. The point is once the ceasefire was brokered, once the Serb guns stopped firing, and people could walk out of their front doors, walk around the city, there really was, for the first time, there was a slight break, a slight sense of relief, a slight sense that things may be actually getting better. And this was a palpable feeling. But as I say, I don't think the Bosnian government shared this feeling because they were determined on airstrikes coming.
Where did you stay in Sarajevo?
I sort of book in at the Holiday Inn, which, is this very exposed yellow building.
What's left of it?
Oh, the Holiday Inn is more or less okay. It took a bit of a battering at the beginning of the war, but the point is that the Bosnian Serbs haven't attacked it because they know that all of us foreign journalists are staying there. So I stay there partly, and then I stay with friends in town. That always gives you a different perspective. I mean, if you're staying there in the Holiday Inn with journalists, most of whom I must say were very much in favour of airstrikes coming, and indeed, everybody started pouring into the Holiday Inn as soon as the ultimatum took place. Peter Arnett pitched up for CNN, so obviously there was a sense amongst some newsrooms that the missiles were going to fall, and you could tell there was a real sort of sense of, yes, at last there are going to be airstrikes and this is going to be a great story and so on and so forth. And that becomes a rather weird, hysterical atmosphere to operate in. So I often go down into town and stay with friends and live a much more sort of miserable lifestyle than you can in the Holiday Inn, but a much more sobering and instructive one.
Your home base is in northern Greece, in Thessalonica. And there was recently, you were telling me, a big demonstration against the United States there. What is behind the anti-American sentiment? What was the demonstration about?
Yeah, well, of course, I pitched up back in Thessalonica, coming out of Sarajevo with all the sort of psychosis around the ultimatum. I didn't stay for the running out of the ultimatum. And the minute I got back there was this enormous 100,000-strong Greek demonstration outside the US consulate in Thessalonica. Stones were thrown, eggs were thrown. There were a lot of very hostile banners, a lot of screaming, hysterical people, and it was a very distressing thing to watch indeed. This was a response by the Greeks, popular response to the decision of the Clinton administration to recognize the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia.
Now, the Clinton administration decided to recognize the former Yugoslavian Republic of Macedonia at about the same time that the NATO deadline was issued. Now, Macedonia has the same name as the province in northern Greece.
That's right.
Why is that so important? Why does that matter?
The point is that the Greeks say that the name Macedonia in the Republic of Macedonia implies that Macedonia has territorial claims on the Greek province of Macedonia of that name, of which Thessalonica is the capital. The problem is it goes beyond that into it turns into also a sort of Greek nationalist response, saying they don't want to see the name Macedonia whatsoever, and that the Macedonians must change their flag, which has a symbol largely associated with Greek Macedonia, the son of Vergina, and they must change their constitution and so on and so forth. And they have a string of demands, some of which I think are pretty legitimate. I think the one about the use of the son of Vergina on the Macedonian flag, that's an outrageous... Well, it's a provocation on the part of the Macedonians, and the son ought to be able to go. But the name problem is more difficult. But it goes well beyond that, of course. Macedonia is a very, very delicate state with not really a great deal of internal consensus. And none of its four neighbours, Greece, Albania, Serbia or Bulgaria, really are very happy with the existence of Macedonia of a state for very different reasons.
Isn't part of the reason why you've stationed yourself in Greece to observe what happens there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I moved down to Thessalonica because I'm very concerned about the possibility of war in the southern Balkans, and also because nobody had really attempted to understand what the Greek position was. The general response in the world to the Greek position is that it's a load of irrational nonsense.
And I think the general response here is, another country, I can't follow it. There's too much I have to understand anyways. If there's any way I don't have to understand about Greece, that's good.
I know. You're dead right. The interesting thing is, of course, is we've perceived Greece as being, you know, integrated into the European Union. And, you know, I mean, it's seen as a Western democracy, of course. But as soon as you have a destabilization of the Balkans, then certain concerns leap up the Greek political agenda, and its political behaviour changes accordingly. But the point that you're making is dead right. I mean, during the course of this interview, for example, I'm constantly reminded that a lot of these facts, which are sort of self-evident to me because I've been studying the region for a long time, must be just baffling for anybody trying to work out where these places are, what the relationship between that country and why should they go to war over that or whatever. The only thing that I can say is that there is now a real danger of the destabilization of the southern Balkans, of a much bigger Balkan war than that which we've seen already in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And so, however sort of mind-boggling these problems may appear to be, they are problems that we have got to address and got to address publicly, and we've got to do it soon.
Misha Glenny is the author of The Fall of Yugoslavia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Misha Glenny will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we continue our conversation with journalist Misha Glenny. He's been covering the war in Bosnia since its start. We'll talk about his fear of the war spreading and how covering this war has changed his life. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Robert Olin Butler's They Whisper and Nicholson Baker's The Fermata, two novels about sexual obsession. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Israeli army has released its count of the number of people killed in the Hebron Mosque last Friday. The BBC's Alex Brody reports.
The army has given figures for the first time. It says that on Friday, the Jewish settler Baruch Goldstein killed 30 Palestinians in the mosque, and elsewhere in Hebron, five died in clashes with troops. The families of Goldstein's victims are to be given compensation, though less than Israelis would get, the cost of living in the occupied territories being adjudged less than in Israel proper. Some 500 Palestinian prisoners were released this morning, members of organizations in favor of the peace deal. The PLO says they were due to end their prison terms soon anyway. After 3 days of violent protest, the Israeli authorities are anxiously hoping for calm. Arab areas of Israel proper seem quiet so far. Rioting there has shaken the government. The three-day strike in the West Bank and Gaza has ended, but blanket curfews remain in force.
Alex Brody reporting. President Clinton and British Prime Minister John Major have finished their official meeting at the White House. Both men say they want to bring peace to Bosnia. Mr. Clinton says he hopes NATO's downing of four warplanes yesterday will push the peace process along. The warplanes reportedly belong to the Bosnian Serbs. They were fired on after they violated the UN no-fly zone over Bosnia. Premier Major says the Sarajevo ceasefire proves that peace can work in the region. Both say they've decided to send a joint mission to Sarajevo to see what the region needs in order to rebuild. Two police officers have testified that anti-abortion activist Michael Griffin admitted shooting Dr. David Gunn behind his Pensacola abortion clinic last March. Debbie Elliott has more.
Sergeant Ken Franks is one of two police officers who took the stand for the prosecution today. The officers were called to Pensacola Women's Medical Services on March 10th on a complaint about protesters in front of the clinic. Franks testified that Michael Griffin approached him and confessed to shooting someone behind the clinic.
I asked him, after he repeated the second time that a man had been shot behind the building, I asked who shot him. He said he did. I asked where the gun was, and he told me the gun was on the ground behind the building.
Judge John Parnum rejected defense motions to strike one of the officers' testimony or declare a mistrial because of confusion about when the officers advised Griffin of his constitutional rights. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Pensacola, Florida.
The government says the economy expanded by 7.5% in the last quarter of 1993. The Commerce Department says the increase in the gross domestic product was higher than analysts expected. Stock prices closed sharply lower today on Wall Street. The Dow lost 22.79 points to end at 3,809. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. The Khmer Rouge guerrillas of Cambodia have retaken a major base on the Cambodian side of the Thai border. Government troops had taken it last month and claimed they would hold it forever. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Bangkok.
When Anlong Veng fell in mid-February, government troops celebrated it as a turning point in their drawn-out struggle against the Khmer Rouge. So swift was the Khmer Rouge's departure in the face of 2,000 attacking government troops that hardline Khmer Rouge General Tom Mak apparently left his artificial leg behind. But now the Khmer Rouge are back. Their return was made easier by the government's apparent overconfidence. Only one-fourth of the troops that attacked last month remained to guard the base. They beat a hasty retreat a couple of days ago when the Khmer Rouge started lobbing artillery shells at them. Having proclaimed the capture of Anlong Veng a big stepping stone toward the Khmer Rouge's ultimate defeat, government troops now find that their enemy is nowhere near as weak as they had claimed. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Bangkok.
A private business group says sales of existing homes dropped 3% in January. The National Association of Realtors says bad weather is to blame, along with higher mortgage rates. But the trade group says sales were still at their second highest level on record. Sales fell from the December level in every region, including the West. The Environmental Protection Agency is releasing final regulations today that will make chemical firms cut air pollution. The rules will force big companies to install new equipment at more than 350 plants nationwide over the next 3 years. The equipment is supposed to cut toxic air pollution by millions of pounds. The cost of the equipment is hundreds of millions of dollars. The states expected to benefit the most from the new regulations are Texas, Louisiana, and New Jersey, where there are several chemical processing facilities. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Misha Glenny. Glenny has covered the war in Bosnia for the BBC and is the author of The Fall of Yugoslavia. In the first part of our show, we talked about the latest developments in the war. We asked him to talk with us now about how covering the war has affected him. But first I wanted to hear what he thinks is the next big decision NATO will have to make now that it's downed four Serbian planes. And now that the NATO deadline has run out on the ultimatum to the Serbs, demanding they withdraw their heavy artillery from Sarajevo.
If any guns return to Sarajevo, or if anything is fired on Sarajevo, then the NATO ultimatum is still in force, and NATO has, according to that ultimatum, every commitment to go in and take them out. So that ultimatum remains. I mean, they cannot come back into Sarajevo. There has also been great pressure from the United Nations, with support from NATO countries, to open Tuzla Airport. And it seems as though we have this agreement today which will facilitate that. The Serbs have agreed, after a visit of the Bosnian Serb leader Karadzic to Moscow. But there is this problem as to what the ultimatum was specifically around Sarajevo, and trying to create new ultimatums is going to be very difficult, because the ultimatum itself was a very carefully worded and specifically targeted against Sarajevo, given the particular situation pertaining to the Bosnian capital. And that same situation does not pertain anywhere else in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Certainly, I think if the Serbs continue with provocations using aircrafts as they did yesterday, then NATO will respond again. There's no question about that.
Do you have any idea of whether the guns that have been moved away from Sarajevo are being taken, or at least taken in part, to other besieged cities or to new fronts?
Well, I was very interested in one of the things that the New York Times was saying today, that this group of UN observers suddenly saw a whole stream of Serbian tanks being pulled out from within the exclusion zone in Sarajevo, and were completely baffled by where they came from. So obviously, I mean, the UN and NATO hasn't been doing quite as much close observing as it should have done. If these, they've obviously got some weapons still hidden there, which is outrageous, and I hope the matter gets taken up. Unfortunately, of course, what does seem to be happening is that these weapons are being taken out from around Sarajevo, and it would appear moved around towards Tuzla and Maglaj. Maglaj is the pits, the worst of the worst. It's even worse than Eastern Mostar, we gather. There are some sort of 20, 25,000 people in the Maglaj pocket. Estimates vary. It comes under the most frightful attack from the Serbs, day in, day out, and it's probably on the verge of falling. And it seems as though the Serbs have moved some of the firepower from around Sarajevo to around Maglaj and Tuzla, and just, pummeling these areas, which is obviously a rather, despondent, depressing development. I might add that around Maglaj, the Serbs work tactically together with the Croats.
When the war in Bosnia started, you were reporting for the BBC. You've since left the BBC. Why did you leave? And I'm wondering if that had to do with the war.
Partly because, it was basically because I was working too hard. But although, having said that, since I've left the BBC, I've been working even harder, and I'm more sort of exhausted and traumatized than I was when I was working with the Beeb. It was also because if you work for the BBC, it's very, very important that you're utterly objective and you do not... you do not opine, you do not give your opinions on what's happening in the war. And more I felt I had to be opinionated, and I had to start taking positions on the way that the war was being run, both from the international community and from the warring factions. And working for the BBC did restrict me in doing that. And now that I'm working as a freelancer, I don't have any such restrictions at all. Of course, it makes you much more unpopular when you're more open about your thoughts.
And what is being more unpopular? How is that affecting you?
Well, it's frankly beginning to wear me down. Just to take an example, 2 weeks ago, I was attacked simultaneously in the Bulgarian and the Greek press. The Bulgarians accused me of working for the Greek secret service and trying to restrict Bulgarian legitimate Bulgarian concerns in the region, and the Greeks attacked me for working for the Macedonians and saying that I was living in Thessaloniki off using Greek hospitality in order to undermine Greek interests, and I'm sick of it. I get accused by everyone, by every side, of working for the Serbs, of being a Muslim sympathizer, and it's all completely absurd. But within the context, when you're working in a war situation, and if you're relatively well known, it can be dangerous, and I don't feel safe anymore in Sarajevo. I don't feel particularly safe in the Bosnian Serb held areas either. The Croats seem to have forgotten me mercifully, and so I feel a little more comfortable in Zagreb than I used to. But it is a matter both of one's own physical safety, but also of the psychology of being permanently attacked in a rather rabid fashion by people there, and you know that they're talking absolute codswallop.
So you feel you've become something of a target?
Well, all journalists feel as though they're something of a target inside the war zone, certainly, but I am also a bit of a target outside of the war zones in the sort of diplomatic and political arena. And it can be quite tough. But the good thing is, the fact that I travel around inside the former Yugoslavia and keep in touch with the international players outside means that, to be perfectly honest, there are very few people who have quite the amount of understanding of what the relationship between what's going on the ground with the sort of broader political aspects are. And so it's very difficult for people to sort of argue with me.
My guest is Misha Glenny, author of The Fall of Yugoslavia. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with journalist Misha Glenny. It seems to me your whole life has been changed by this war.
I've been traumatized by it. Everyone who's been involved in it for a long time is traumatized. I am imprisoned by the former Yugoslavia. I can't get out. I'm sick of it. I want to get out. But while the war goes on and my friends are sitting there in Sarajevo being bombed, I can't do it. You know, I have made my reputation as a journalist out of this war, which is a terrible thing to say because it means you made your reputation on a sort of, you know, pile of flesh and blood. And if I were to sort of walk away and I couldn't say to my friends in Sarajevo, you know, well, thanks a lot. You know, I've written a book about it and I've earned a bit of money and I've earned a reputation and now I've had enough of it. I'm going to go, you know, and live in a cottage in England. I just can't do it. And so as long as the war goes on, I will be there. But you have other things as well. I mean, every week to 10 days, I dream, I have a nightmare. And the nightmare always finishes with me being either shot or having my throat slit or being blown up by a mortar. And it happens, and then I wake up in a cold sweat. And that's happening to me, somebody who can sort of zip in and out because I'm a journalist with international accreditation. I don't have to stay for endless days in Sarajevo. Can you imagine what is going to happen to the Balkan peoples, particularly those in Bosnia and Croatia and indeed in Serbia who've suffered because of the Balkan War? It is going to be one heaving mass of psychos because, you know, they have been through, endured suffering, which frankly was is just unimaginable.
So like in your nightmares, you have the kind of nightmare where you're somebody's target and they're actually looking to get you, plus you've got the nightmare where you're just the kind of bystander who's hit by a shell.
No, it tends to be, you know, I'm walking down the road and in an entirely sort of innocent situation. They're always different situations. There's no pattern to them. I don't know that it's going to happen at all. I mean, I could be dreaming about Salonika or London or America or wherever, and suddenly something happens, mm-hmm. and then I just have this brief moment where I know it's going to happen. I know I'm going to get killed, you know, and I sort of, you know, tense up, and then comes the knife or the guns or the mortar. And then I wake up and, you know, and I mean, people, I have experienced nothing compared to some of these poor civilian populations in Bosnia-Herzegovina, the Muslims in particular. I've experienced nothing to that extent. But I have seen a lot of people being killed in front of my eyes. I have seen a lot of dead bodies. I have had a lot of shells explode near me and that sort of thing. And I'm traumatized by it, you know.
You know, you've been generous enough with your time to speak with us several times on Fresh Air about the war in the former Yugoslavia. And from the very first visit on our show, you've been warning about the possibility of the war spreading. And the reasons why it might spread, as we talked about before, are very complicated, and it requires a certain understanding of history and of the present to understand this threat of the war spreading. It must be very frustrating for you to feel that you have this information, you have this knowledge, you want to communicate it, but it's so hard to do because people are so overwhelmed by the amount of information they're already trying to process.
Yeah, that's dead right. I mean, the other problem is as well that people expect, if you start warning about the war spreading, people expect it to happen next day.
Right, right.
You know, and then they come back to you. I mean, as you say, ever since we've been talking, I've been saying this, and you come back and you could legitimately say, well, it hasn't spread, has it? You were talking a load of nonsense. And the point that I try and make and try and get through to people as much as possible is that at the moment the things are developing along a trajectory in the southern Balkans which will inevitably lead to war unless they're knocked off that trajectory. Now, it may not be tomorrow, it may not be in 6 months' time, it may be in 2 years' time or 3 years' time, but come it shall unless there is some sort of political response. And of course, it's not just ordinary people who are baffled by the whole thing. It's governments, you know, and because it's not just the Balkans. This is after 1989. We've got the whole black hole of Russia, the problem of the near abroad places like Ukraine. We've got the situation in the Middle East. We've got the possibility of a civil war breaking out in South Africa, a major trade dispute between the United States and Japan. And this is a sort of policy agenda which nobody can cope with.
You know, it's much easier to focus on the personal dramas in the war, what it's like to live in a city under siege and everything. I'm not saying it's easy to focus. It's easier to comprehend the war on that level. It's easier to digest it. It's more difficult to kind of bring history into play and all the policy stuff, and all the, as you put it before, the broader political games. As a journalist, how have you been trying to maintain a balance between describing the personal drama of the war and also bringing kind of history and politics into play, which are essential to understanding why this war is happening?
Well, basically, the bulk of journalists covering this war do it through the sort of personal trauma. That actually doesn't interest me as much. I felt that once the first exchange of massacres took place between Serbs and Croats in 1991, then I really felt that we were going to see a whole string of these, and it was going to get nastier and nastier, and that is indeed what happened to be the case. And there are journalists who document these, and they do a great job, and they document them very well, and it's extremely vivid writing. And so on and so forth. I think there is enough of that material in the press for me not to have to do it. I mean, I do colour stuff, as we call it, now and then, and I do attempt to inject colour into my writing so that it's easier for people to sort of access what I'm trying to say. But for me, it's absolutely essential that the political history of these wars is properly recorded, because we have made some gross mistakes. The international community has made some gross mistakes, which in my opinion have led directly to the execution of massacres, particularly in eastern Bosnia. I think the international community has a very serious responsibility for what it did, in particular by recognizing Croatia prematurely. And what tends to happen is that when these massacres come out, and everyone is rightly disgusted and appalled and horrified by them, they then tend to forget what is the political responsibility for those massacres. Obviously, the war responsibility is the Bosnian Serbs to a large degree. But you have to remember the political responsibility, because it seems to me that the international community is all too often quite happy to make chronic political mistakes, which results in enormous suffering for hundreds of thousands of people in the former Yugoslavia. And then while all this sort of suffering is going on, the West is just sort of blithely washing its hands of its own responsibility. And so, you know, I mean, there's a moral question, but there is a political question which we dare not lose sight of.
Misha Glenny, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you good luck on your travels.
Thanks very much.
Misha Glenny is the author of The Fall of Yugoslavia. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Today, close to the Brooklyn Bridge in New York, four Hasidic Jews were wounded. They were riding in a van. A witness said the gunman yelled in Arabic, "Kill the Jews." Ann Cooper reports from South Africa on how the campaign of Nelson Mandela is going. The presidential election there is coming up late in April. Brooke Gladstone on the visit to Moscow by Radovan Karadzic, the leader of the Bosnian Serbs, and word that the Serbs have agreed to reopen the airport at Tuzla in Bosnia. Also, Alexander Solzhenitsyn says goodbye to his neighbors in Vermont. He was expelled from the Soviet Union in 1974. He's returning home.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic Maureen Corrigan says sometimes book reviewing can be dirty work.
This weekend, my assignment was to review those two new male sex fantasy novels, They Whisper by the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Robert Olin Butler and The Fermata by Nicholson Baker. Reading them was like going on consecutive blind dates with two men who weren't my type. Most of the time, I fended off their authorial advances, but every so often I gave in. Their prose was so seductive, so masterful, so messy. Both Butler and Baker enjoy hot sex scenes involving viscous substances like saliva, semen, mother's milk, menstrual blood, urine, and motor oil. Monday morning, I woke up feeling cheap, used, and desperately in need of a steam cleaning. The narrator of Butler's They Whisper is named Ira Holloway, And he's one of those men who talks a lot about how much he loves his wife, despite the torment she's putting him through. In Ira's case, however, both the love and the torment are real. Ira's wife Fiona is having a mental breakdown. The only things that hold her together are her nightly lovemaking sessions with Ira and her belief in an ultra-Orthodox version of Catholicism. For years, Ira has loyally endured listening to what he calls Fiona's catechism of madness. But recent events have made Ira realize he's got to protect his 8-year-old son, John, from Fiona's religious zeal. Large parts of They Whisper are written in the form of stream-of-consciousness recollections about sex. Ira thinks it's essential for him to understand his own sex drive and how it's directed his life. The many women Ira has slept with begin to break into the narrative and speak for themselves. This is Butler's praiseworthy attempt to give these women their own voices. But since they mostly talk about what a great lover Ira is, their monologues don't really diversify the viewpoint very much. Butler is a lush writer, and he makes both Ira's emotional pain and his physical appreciation of women's bodies very vivid. Here, for instance, is Ira's meditation on a woman's lips. They were very full, and they began the morning painted bright poppy red. But with each pucker, the paint grew fainter, and it was as if her lips were slowly undressing for me, and their own true color, their pale, labial pink, began to show through. I'll warn you, though, sometimes Butler's overheated metaphors reach manic meltdown, like when he compares a woman's sexual organs to a head of lettuce. That's when you might want to turn to the Fermata for contrast. Nicholson Baker's descriptions of sex go light on lyricism and heavy on plumbing details. The Fermata reads like an R-rated Twilight Zone episode. A geeky guy named Arno Strine discovers the power to stop time, and while everyone around him is frozen, he takes the opportunity to feel up women and masturbate. That's the whole plot for a sticky 300 pages. To give it its due, the Fermata is sometimes very funny. For example, Arno contracts carpal tunnel syndrome from his overactive handwork. He's also very inventive when it comes to sex. The scenarios he concocts involve lawnmowers, toothbrushes, and staplers. If you're undecided about whether or not you'd like the Fermata, here's a surefire test. See if you can answer this rhetorical question Arno poses halfway through the novel. What else, he asks, was there in the world besides masturbation? If your mind just went blank, you'll love this book.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed They Whisper by Robert Olin Butler and The Fermata by Nicholson Baker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our interns are Ann Neville and Devin Reif. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Donna Williams is an autistic woman who can do what very few autistics can, describe what it's like to be shut off from the world. We broadcast an interview with her over a year ago. On the next Fresh Air, she joins us again, this time to talk about how she learned to speak and to write. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.